Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 227, Matt Beiler, Part 1, Black Powder.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding. Oh,
man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Sci-Fi Publishing.
Hey folks, Timothy C. Ward here, and we have a special treat today. Sean Farrell has given us what may be his last interview for a while, and so we have two parts. The first part is him and Matt talking about the epic poem Black Powder, some UFO conspiracies that I didn't know about. So even if you're not into poetry, check this out. It's a pretty cool conversation. Matt writes poetry for, as he calls it, the people who watch Discovery Channel at 3 a.m., so it's not your typical poetry. We are going to have a giveaway on our website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com. This week, we're going to do a giveaway of Sea Change by S.M. Wheeler. We did a review of that a couple weeks ago, and our reviewer was pretty impressed with this story. It looks, maybe magical realism? It's got some emotional twists to it, and looks like a good read. So check out our website for details on that. My friend Carl Anderson is doing a reading challenge, Readers Imbibing Peril, I think is what it's called, the acronym RIP, like on a gravestone. And so from now until October 31st, he's doing a reading challenge over at stainlesssteeldroppings.com, and at least I am taking part of it as part of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, so maybe you will too. Got some books listed on my post, and in the sidebar we have the link to that if you want to check those out and participate. We also had a book review last week by Greg Pelleke. He reviewed James Lovegrove's The Stuff of Nightmares, a Sherlock Holmes tale. Looks like a pretty cool book. It's got some steampunk and Sherlock mystery and adventure, and again, a very positive review, so go check that out. Today's episode is sponsored by Tracy Falby, author of the fantasy novel Riss Rising. Without further ado, enjoy the show.
For Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, this is Sean Farrell, and joining me today is poet, artist, photographer, and literary agent with Sanford J. Greenberg Associates, Matt Beiler. Matt, thank you very much for joining us from your office in Manhattan today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Well, we've already been doing the interview before I hit record, so I know we have lots to discuss and lots to get to. We might not get it all in, but that's the nature of the beast, so to speak. But I really wanted to start off our conversation today with you to talking about your poetry and your newest epic poem, Black Powder, which you were kind enough to send me a copy of and I have read. It's published by Black Coffee Press. And yes. Before we get into really the details of the story, can you tell us a little bit about your background with poetry and why you use this form to tell stories?
Well, I was an English major at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, and I studied poetry. And I think my friends knew me as a poet, and my family knew me as a poet, and I studied it pretty intensely, and it was considered a big deal if you submitted work in order to be able to do a creative thesis as an English major rather than write about some writer or some theory you have about literature. So I was honored to do that. But what happened was I studied poetry. Well, I went to the UK for part of 1984, and I studied poetry there. And it was very different there, and I got very disenchanted. I would receive harsh criticism. I wasn't used to that. Frankly, I was actually used to getting a lot of praise. But, you know, over there a bit, if you don't share the same kind of thinking with your, quote, mentors or professors, you know, instead of just letting you be, they can be a little bit more critical. And I really wasn't prepared for that. So I didn't stop writing then, but when I came back from my senior year in college, I stopped writing completely and I pulled out of doing the creative thesis. And so I always felt very ashamed of myself about that. But I did not write a single word of poetry for 25 years. Yeah. But I still read it. I had many poet friends, and that's why I started doing visual art, because I thought I could do that. So I was very well read in poetry, and I really took my poetic way of thinking and applied it visually, particularly in the photography, I think. And I just, you know, that same passion and energy went into photography. At the same time, I thought I might be an English professor. But because of my disenchantment with writing, I decided not to, but I wanted to be around books, and I love books, so I ended up in publishing. I thought I'd be an editor, but I ended up, by sort of circumstances, becoming a literary agent. So I became a literary agent and always did photography on the side and on my weekends all the time, and I loved it because I was being creative myself, and I was always around creative people. So as I said, I still read poetry, and I thought to myself, because also as an agent, it's interesting, I was thinking about this, everything's very parallel and connected. As an agent, when I finally got promoted, when I was at the William Morris Agency, they said, we'll promote you, but you have to represent science fiction and fantasy. And I was pretty well read, and I had worked for an agent named Perry Knowlton at Curtis Brown, who represented a lot of science fiction writers, including C.J. Cherry and Janet Morris, people like that. And there were a handful of others, and there were a lot of shared universes that he was the agent for. So I was learning the business about it from him, not only just publishing, but also this genre. So when William Morris said, we'll make you an agent if you do science fiction and fantasy, I said, sure. So what was really happening, in a sense, was while I wasn't writing, I was reading lots of poetry, and I was also reading lots of science fiction and fantasy. So when I started again, 25 years later, just out of, I kind of combined the two. And I thought that, you know, not that I have something against the Ivy Tower, I just thought that with poetry, a lot of it's pretty self-indulgent. A lot of it, and I think it puts a lot of the public off. It turns them off. I think they just think that it's very cerebral and it's hard to understand. And I always want it to be accessible. And people sometimes make fun of the poet Billy Collins, who's very popular, but I always thought it was really cool that he's made it accessible. I think Carl Sandburg was a great poet, and he was very accessible and of the people. So I thought, you know, in a kind of humorous way, I want to be a poet of the people of the Discovery Channel at 3 a.m. So, you know, I like these stories because they're really, you know, one like In Black Powder. I like urban myths. I like conspiracy theories. I like UFO stuff. I like Bigfoot. I like all that kind of stuff because they're ultimately a reflection, you know, whether they're true or not, who knows, but they're ultimately a reflection of our current society, you know, which is that we don't trust the government, that there are things greater than ourselves that we can't possibly understand, you know, Area 51, we don't even understand, you know, what's there, and is it our own government? I mean, it is our own government, but we don't, you know, everything is sort of kept from us. And I try and write about that in a human way, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, having just read Black Powder, I know exactly what you're talking about. And really, as I was reading the book, I found it amazing how much story you were able to tell with so few words. And it was kind of refreshing after reading so many epic fantasies over the years, which so often to me fail to justify the number of words they use. Can you talk a little bit about your style and about your writing process and how you are able to get things down with so few words and yet so so to yes, tell so much in the process of doing that?
Well, first of all, I never intended to write these long poems. They kind of found me. When I was first writing again, which was about 4 years ago, I was writing short lyrical pieces, and they were starting to get more about paranormal subjects. Like I'd write about Philip K. Dick, who's not paranormal, but he wrote about that stuff. Or I would write about crop circles, and I started reading more and doing more research, or, you know, Nazi technology. And so I also want to say a good friend of mine is the poet Matthew Rohrer, R-O-H-R-E-R. And if you haven't read him, go check him out. He's a great poet, and he's pretty well known. He just was on the cover in December of the American Poetry Review. So I knew Matthew as a dad because our kids are close in age, and they go to the same small, they just graduated, but they went to the same small elementary school in Brooklyn. And I would hang around him, and we would talk UFOs and music and poetry, but I wasn't writing yet. But I thought, wow, he's a cool guy, and he teaches at NYU. I thought, what a cool guy, because I kind of had this notion that sometimes poets can be full of themselves, or, you know, just very, I don't know. I mean, he and I shared a lot of the same taste and things. So I think he, in a funny way, influenced me writing again. He and a bunch of other friends, and another writer named Chris Sachnusum did too, because he's a great fiction writer, and he wrote Zanesville, and he also is a poet, and he's a visual artist. And we were talking about poetry a lot too, so it started stirring the pot. So anyway, I started to find these stories that fascinated me, because I was looking for subjects that you see these subjects in novels, you see them in nonfiction, you don't see it in poetry. So I thought, wow, like, I want to write about this. But as I would write these poems, they just started getting longer. And I sometimes don't even like long poetry, but they just, in order to really serve them well, I felt like they had to be epic. And especially a fellow like in Black Powder, Jack Parsons. I mean, he's almost too good to be true, or too bad to be true in some cases. Well, it's unbelievable that he hasn't really been dealt with that much. Well, maybe a little bit in fiction, but definitely not in poetry. I mean, he's friends with L. Ron Hubbard. He's friends with Robert Heinlein, and he were at least acquainted with each other.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, I didn't put that in because, you know, there's only so much a lot of that's what it is. It's editing. There's only so much you can put in it. Right. And actually, I take liberties. To me, this is still fiction. So most of this is true. Some of it I speculated about. But, you know, for the listening audience, Jack Parsons was he was one of the key people in inventing the American rocket. And he co-founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And it's interesting, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is not called the Rocket Laboratory, because in the 1930s, the word rocket was sort of a dirty word. It was it was considered the stuff of Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, and no serious person could be interested in rockets. I mean, I don't think there was the tolerance of geeks that there is now.
Right.
But he loved rockets. He loved gun, like explosive powders. As I said, he collected powders the way people collect vintage wines. He had them everywhere where he lived. People used to be afraid to go into his house. And he's an expert in this stuff. And then when the war starts, you know, they have an affiliation with Pasadena, I'm forgetting the name of the university now, University of California, Caltech. So at Caltech, he is not an official student there, but there's a professor who takes he and his friend under his wing. And when the war starts, the American military knows that the Germans are looking to develop rockets. So they start snooping around the universities to see if anyone knows about this stuff. And they find out about Jack Parsons, and so they fund him. But at the same time, he's also seriously, seriously very interested in the occult and Aleister Crowley and all that. So he really had both ends burning, and literally. And that's what this poem is about. It's about how he ends up self-destructing because he does help invent the American rocket, but he also sort of goes out of his mind.
Yeah.
And there, to this day, no one really knows what happened because people had trouble believing that he, you know, what happens at the end and at the beginning of this poem is he blows himself up, and no one knows if it was, if someone did it to him, or did he do it to himself, or did Satan do it to him? We don't know, but it's a fascinating story.
Tracy Falby spent 15 years crafting 8 novels in a Risk fantasy world. In the Risk Chronicles, Dreebound Veda overthrows a goddess, wins the greatest treasure ever, and then must face a reckoning with the great empire of his homeland that he betrayed. In Risk Rising, Amar rises as the unstoppable warlord of Anja. He conquers great cities and gathers armies to take against the ancient and magical realm of Nifal. Readers worldwide have enjoyed Falby's fiction. Teresa H. said, "The Riss are unlike any characters in any other fantasy books I've ever read." Falby invites you to read Riss Rising Book 1, your gateway to a new reading addiction. Download free samples, enjoy bundle discounts, and find links to your favorite ebook retailers at braveluck.com.
You mentioned that you stuck as close as you could to historical record, but there are some areas where you had to speculate for story purposes and because we don't know for sure. What are some of the areas that were somewhat your interpretations of your research trying to figure out what you thought really happened with him?
Well, most of that is in the realm of what is going on in his head. And we know for a fact that he would go around quoting Aleister Crowley all the time, and before some of these testings of the rockets, he would start reciting the hymn to Pan by Crowley. And you know, his scientist friends would just say, "Oh, don't mind him. They kind of didn't take it seriously in him. They did notice that he would not bathe when he'd be in the next day. He'd smell because he had been partying, and he would have massive orgies at his mansion, and this is in the 1940s. And eventually, the U.S. government was like, "Who is this guy? He's nuts." and they actually pushed him out. It's kind of sad. He helps invent the American rocket, and by the end, he is doing explosive stuff for Hollywood. You know, when someone gets shot and a little puff of smoke comes out of their chest or something. Jack would do that. But I took liberties in what was going on in his mind. So I kind of took Crowley's automatic writing and his, and also some of Jack's, and I sort of combined them with mine. And I really had fun with this whole, you know, Babylon stuff and, you know, how he wanted to create a devil child eventually. And also, there is this whole thing where he meets the Scarlet Woman, and that was not made up. He really thought this woman that he met was the Scarlet Woman of myth. And she lived a very long time, and she was an artist. Mm. But it's hard to find out a lot about her because she lived a sort of reclusive life. Mm. But I took liberties mostly in what goes on in Jack's mind because he didn't leave many writings behind. So I just had this, and not many of his friends have ever gone on the record to really talk about him that much.
Yeah, it was fascinating, the juxtaposition between the work he's doing professionally and then his personal life with this obsession that he has with the occult and really sort of accessing these powers that he's striving for, and then watching as the story went on, he's no longer able to separate those.
No,
the barriers break
down,
and
it's sort of tragic. Yeah, like he kept it pretty separate, and you really see. I mean, I hope that if there's one thing that I did, that I hope I was able to convey how brilliant he was, and also what a romantic he is. I think he had a lot more to him than just a straight scientist. He really. You know, he would write these beautiful love letters to his girlfriends and wives, and I mean, there was a sort of innocence about him. I think he also just was a classic multitasker. He doing science and rockets was just not enough to satisfy his curiosity. But I think he took it too far, unfortunately.
He's obviously a figure that's important to science fiction because of his research and, you know, the inventions that he helped to bring about, which inspired science fiction readers, you know, in generations following. You even mentioned this in the book that he was a fan of science fiction himself and grew up reading these pulp magazines.
Yeah, and he would seek out science fiction writers. His best friend at one point was L. Ron Hubbard. And actually, you can, you know, I don't think it's said in the world of Scientology and Dianetics, but Jack had a huge influence on Hubbard inventing his own religion. And Hubbard had said to him, we don't need this Crowley stuff. We could do something on our own. But Jack wasn't interested in inventing a new religion. I think he just wanted to see if there were powers. I think he was interested in powers greater than himself. I think that's ultimately why he was so curious and why science and powders just were not enough for him. If that makes any sense.
Absolutely. And in the story at the end, I don't want to give too much away, but him and Hubbard have some experiences. Are those experiences that were documented, or
yes? The stuff that goes on in the mansion, their experiments, the winds that Hubbard felt something on his shoulder. That is true. And also, I don't want to give it away, but Hubbard ends up betraying Jack. At least according to Jack, I've never heard the other side. And Hubbard runs off with Jack's wife. I don't think Jack cared that much anyway about that. Jack was not interested in being in a monogamous relationship. And he was probably strangely ahead of his time in that way. But when Hubbard and Jack's wife try to steal the yachts, it is somewhat true. Well, it is true that Jack went to his room and he prayed to Satan and he did all this chanting and this storm occurred and Hubbard had to come back into port. That is true. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. I mean, whether Jack caused it or not, or whether it was a coincidence, who knows, right? But it's a great story. So I could not believe it. No one was telling this story. And it's interesting that you say I write these long poems, and yes, they are economical. And one of my favorite all-time poets is William Carlos Williams, who always wrote close to the bone, and I always admired that about him.
The writers that you mentioned, L. Ron Hubbard, that he knew Robert Heinlein, at least to some degree, were there any other science fiction writers at that time, names that we would know, that Parsons was associated with?
You know, there are, but I forgot who they are. I don't know off the top of my head. I know he went out of his way to seek some out. He loved reading the pulp magazines. I think he wanted to be a writer himself. I mean, he wrote his own poetry sometimes. I know Heinlein, you know, when it was brought up about Jack, Heinlein would sort of distance himself from him. Like, according to Heinlein, he said, I was only acquainted with Jack. Because Jack kind of muddied his own reputation, so people like Heinlein did not want to be associated with him. But, you know, there's a statue of Jack Parsons at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but I don't really think they go around, you know, promoting him as one of the big founders because of his strange background. And I discovered this story when I was researching another poem. I would just go, wow, that guy's interesting. So I'd flag a website or something to look at some point.
That's interesting. Did you finish that other poem?
Yes, but I cannot remember which one it was. I like historical, I like historical UFO stories. They interest me about the beginnings of people seeing lights in the sky. You know, of course, there was Roswell in 1947, but in the early 50s, there were people starting to photograph, you know, lights, and there was a man named George Ademski, who's he's not the first. I think it's Kenneth Arnold was, quote, the first one to photograph the lights. I think it was in the 1952-ish. Don't hold me to that date, but George Ademski would photograph and do movies of various, quote, UFOs. And he also claimed that he, went aboard spaceships and he met them. And what I find interesting is back then, most of the time, aliens are not little green men or the gray species that we hear about. They were people, humanoids in silver suits and long flowing hair. And it's interesting how the perception evolves. You know, now we would laugh at that because it looks like a Michael Rene movie, you know, except Michael Rene did not have long flowing hair. But I find these stories, and they're fascinating to me. And again, you know, they get written about in fiction and nonfiction, but I wanted to put them into poetry because poetry, you know, very much deals with myth. You know, it whether it's Homer or Chaucer or Dante, you know, so, but all that stuff has sort of been done. So I wanted to write about things that you don't see in poetry that are their own kind of mythology. It's the mythology of that includes the internet, though, and the Discovery Channel and the History Channel.
Yeah, it's just, this may be a little obscure, but you know, I'm just thinking here as you're researching and writing this story, and you're able to find a lot of facts that really occurred, and then some things we don't know. The knowledge of what really happened was never recorded, so it's knowledge that's lost. And I remember early on in Black Powder, Parsons is you're discussing some of the things that he was reading as a child, including things that were lost in history. I remember there's a mention of flamethrowers used by the Byzantine Empire. And it just got me thinking about all these things that used to be that we've forgotten that are no longer around. And there's sort of this theme of knowledge gained, knowledge lost, the search for knowledge, the, you know, inevitability that you can't hold on to it. Is that something that you wanted to explore, or am I just totally in left field?
That's correct. The other interesting thing is that Jack actually, because he was a romantic, used his knowledge of history and mythology and science fiction to help him come up with a breakthrough for inventing the rocket. And that's in the book too, how he has this revelation about that. And he uses, you know, mythology and history to figure it out. I don't think he intentionally did, but he was interested in that stuff. He was interested in the history of, you know, gunpowder itself. And he had his own notions of not gunpowder, but explosives and fires. And he liked the idea that flamethrowers existed in biblical times. So, I think I'm trying to do something like that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a whole other page of questions not related to Black Powder I want to ask, but before we change subject, is there anything else about Black Powder that you wanted to highlight that I haven't mentioned?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I have a bunch of books out. One is called Already Here, which you can get on Amazon. Another is called Arc, that you can get at the blackcoffeepress.net website. And I have one forthcoming in August called Bridge from Leaky Boot Press. And that will be available on Amazon and BNN. And I think that most of my poetry explores stories like this one in Black Powder. Black Powder is actually the longest one I ever wrote. And actually, in a lot of ways, it was the hardest thing I ever wrote. I mean, I usually always write notes and have a map of what I'm going to do. And for some reason with Black Powder, I didn't. I did it all from my head. And I, at one point, sort of halfway through, I felt almost at sea. I was like, how am I going to bring this baby home? Because I knew how it was going to end, but I had to get there. And I had, you know, I sort of wrote it as I went along. I did not, usually I have a lot of notes, like, you know, next is this, next is that. I did have notes, but they were in my head. So the other poems I've written are not as long, and but they are UFO stories. They're, I did something on skinwalkers. I did something on, you know, I came across something about a, this combines everything, it's quite extraordinary. If you Google Project Serpo, S-E-R-P-O, there is stuff out there in the conspiracy theory world that that Roswell occurred and that one of the beings survived, and we kept that being for 5 years, and we established contact with the planet, And in 1965, we sent 12, it's like in Close Encounters, we sent 12 military astronauts to this planet 38 light years away. Now, it sounds insane, but, and I'm not interested whether it's true or not. It's very interesting. And, you know, supposedly there are six people from the U.S. government who went on this website and started dumping information. They didn't dump photographs, though they claim they tried. But they dumped a lot of the journals from these astronauts who, eight of them came back, two died. One died on the way there, another died there, and two decided to stay. They came back 13 years later in 1978. Now, it's probably obviously not true, but who knows? But I like it as a story. Like, it raises so many things. So I, usually with a story like that, I also have a contemporary part of the poem about something happening with someone now that connects to what happened in 1965. It turns out it's a descendant of one of the astronauts who, according to his family, all they know is that his aunt had disappeared in the 60s, and that was it. There was no, because apparently the government, what they supposedly would have done with these 12 people is sheep dip them. In other words, erase their existence. College records are pulled. Their IRS records are pulled. So I was really interested in, can you really erase someone? That was one of, you know, just imagining that. So I use these subjects to get into real human things. Otherwise, they would get too weird.
When I was in San Diego, I studied acting for a while. And one of the things I remember studying is the importance of not judging your character, because you can't give an honest portrayal of someone if you are judging them and think that they're bad or evil or whatever. And so I love the fact that as you're discussing these, you know, this story that you just told me about the astronauts traveling to this other planet, that you've been like this throughout the whole interview here. You're open to things that we don't understand and to other possibilities. And that shows in the writing, because if you were judgmental and like, oh, this stuff's all crazy, these people are nuts, you wouldn't be able to write about this subject matter with authenticity. At least that's my opinion. So I love the fact you're open to the things. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm open to it, and I like them as stories, and there's a reason why
they
exist and people react to them.
Right.
You know, and I think that this Serpo story, you know, I showed my father stuff on this, and my father is not what you'd call a believer in things like this, though he believes in that there's life in other planets, but he doesn't believe in UFOs. And he just said, someone who's an amazing science fiction writer had to have written this, or this is true. And that's why it's so interesting, because it's the detail of this planet, you know, traveling through wormholes to get there, the climate, the food, what they looked like, the society. It's really interesting. And it's interesting on so many levels. It's interesting that someone made it up. But it's interesting if it's true. It's the greatest story ever told, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why it interests me, and it interested me about erasing someone's existence too. I think that's really what fascinated me. And but I try, and it's like I look at something three dimensionally. I walk around it. I look at it from many facets, you know, because that's what makes a story interesting. And I don't judge, you know, because I believe that people who are passionate about something have a reason behind it.
And you can't write a story like Black Powder if you as the author have judged Parsons for some of the things that he was involved with. You know, it just would come across as condescending, I think. And so, I just thought you did a really good job, in particular
Thank
that
you.
Aspect. Yeah. And actually, one quick question about that. Why is Crowley on the cover of the book? You know, it's his face that's in the rocket.
He looks so cool. I don't
amazing.
Know. Scott Rogers, who's the publisher and book designer of Black Coffee Press, he is just great at these covers, and he just read it and he came back to me and showed that to me, and I went, wow, that is cool looking. I might have put Jack on it, because Jack is actually he kind of looks like he was a very handsome guy with a pencil thin mustache, but I think he wasn't menacing looking. He looked like just a really nice guy. Whereas I think Crowley is really, you know, I mean, he was, his nickname was the Beast for a reason.
I saw a picture of Parsons on Wikipedia, and having him in the rocket wouldn't be nearly as menacing looking as Crowley.
No, he'd look like Fly the Friendly Skies or something.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Tracy Falby. You can check out her book, Risks Rising, at braveluck.com.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.